The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Welcome to the future you. Frank Lloyd Wright once said, "Study nature, love nature, stay close to nature, and it will never fail you." At Zija, we love nature. We study nature. In India, we discovered Moringa and created Moringa Supermix, a revolutionary new combination of organic ingredients, including natural vitamins, minerals, proteins, antioxidants, and omega oils. Zija's new Moringa Supermix will help you make a change for the better. Simply click on the Zija banner on the UKHealthRadio.com homepage. Power people need power vitality.
Hi, welcome to the Yes to Life show. I'm Robin Daly. If you're a regular listener, you'll know that the show's going to be about some aspect of integrative medicine for cancer, which means there's a lot to talk about, as integrative medicine is a very inclusive approach that embraces both conventional and complementary medicine. My guest today is a hero of mine, tackling a problem head-on that to me was of equal importance to patient choice at the time that I was setting up Yes to Life. In the event, I knew I couldn't do both effectively, and so I chose to tackle choice in healthcare. But I was over the moon to hear about Dr. Robin Youngson, an anaesthetic consultant from New Zealand, who was out there talking about compassion in healthcare. Robin is a man of great courage and singular determination, and it's an honour that he's agreed to talk to us today from Auckland over Skype. Hi Robin, thanks very much for coming on the show today.
Oh, it's very much my pleasure to join you. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, it's lovely to be speaking to you. It must be a good 2 or more years since we last spoke. But yeah, you're one of my idols. I'm a huge fan of your work, promoting care and compassion in healthcare, a massively needed task. You've been doing such amazing work for such a long period, and I'm really glad that someone is doing it.
Oh, thank you, Robin. I didn't know I had any idols. So.
you've got fans. Okay, yes. So in the past, I had the idea that the serious deficit of care and empathy in our NHS was a kind of British peculiarity, a sort of hangover from the stiff upper lip British Empire period. So it was a surprise to learn that health services around the globe seem to suffer from exactly the same dehumanising condition. So you've got any idea how this happened?
I have. Over the 13 or 40 years we've been working on this, we've now visited about 15 countries doing this work. And you're right in that we find the exact same conditions and the exact same problems in every single country we visit, whether it's in socialized healthcare systems like New Zealand and the UK, or in more commercially driven systems and like in the USA, in different cultures, in the Far East, in the Middle East, in Europe. And everywhere we go, it's the same problem.
It's extraordinary.
We see healthcare services that are extremely stressed, 30 to 50% of all health professionals burning out, and really healthcare in a state of crisis. And so we've been thinking a great deal about, you know, how did we get to this place? Why is healthcare so different from the kind of hopes and ideals of doctors and nurses and therapists and midwives who chose their career in the caring profession?
Do you have a bit of a theory as to what it is about healthcare that leads to this enormously different result from, as you say, what everybody might have expected when they went in, you know, young and hopeful, wanting to really help people?
I think there are multiple different factors, and some of them are more recent and some of them go back a long way. Some of the more recent factors are just as medicine has invented more and more possibilities of treatment and is keeping older and older people alive for longer, the demand for healthcare has escalated just dramatically. And when I qualified as a doctor, we had a rule that no one over the age of 70 years would be admitted to a coronary care unit if they had a heart attack. We'd just send them home. Now there are 90-year-olds going to the catheter lab and having cardiac stents and, you know, high-tech, highly expensive care. Mm-hmm. So the possibilities of healthcare and the demand for care are such that the system is in overwhelm. And when I qualified as a doctor in the 1980s, the average length of stay of a hospital inpatient was about a week. Now we do the same amount of work, or maybe three times as much work, in just 2 days. So there are tremendous pressures of time. And one of the factors, one of the responses to that is that the professional managers looked at the old-fashioned kind of healthcare services that run by doctors and nurses and said, that's really inefficient. You need some professional skills in running efficient services. So we've had a corporatization and a professionalization of healthcare that's now led to a situation which we call the industrialization of healthcare, where the focus so much is on budget and throughput and shorter and shorter and quicker appointments and targets in the emergency department. And this this intense drive to do more and more work more and more quickly is one of the factors leading, first of all, to burnout of health professionals, and secondly, to a very deep dissatisfaction of patients, because instead of having a doctor or a nurse that has the time to really listen and make the human connection and to diagnose not just the current symptoms but the underlying causes, we have this kind of knee-jerk kind of medicine where patient presents with symptoms, write a prescription, out the door in 10 minutes. So that's one of the recent factors.
Right. Okay, well, look, the times when we're very ill or injured, they're some of the most vulnerable times in our lives and times when we're actually most in need of care. So you've dedicated, you know, more than a decade to the effort to bring compassion into healthcare. I presume the issue must have been blindingly obvious to many, but thought to be some sort of unattainable goal. So what prompted you to attempt this Herculean task?
I remember the day when I decided I no longer had a choice about that. That's what I call my radicalization. That was the beginning of the Holy Crusade. It actually goes back several decades before that, because you mentioned the kind of the British stiff upper lip. I grew up in the UK. My dad was a doctor, so I was interested in medicine and caring. But I spent, because he was in the army, he spent a great deal of his career in overseas hospitals. And as a consequence, I spent some years in a boarding school in England. And I think the English boarding school really is the archetypal model for the hospital culture.
Right.
Because if you think about small children, I was 10 when I went to boarding school, you're sent to this dreadful place. You're forcibly separated from your loved ones. You lose your identity. I was never called by my first name, only my second name. You have to wear a uniform. You're subject to just completely arbitrary rules and this kind of rigid timetable. You're served the most awful institutional food. There's no privacy. You have shared dormitory, shared bathrooms, and it's lights out at 10 o'clock. And the person in charge, who's a fearsome character, is matron.
Right.
So my experience at English boarding school really made me empathize with the experience of patients within hospitals, and I knew suffering. So for my whole career, I've been an advocate for patients, and I try to support them. But in 2004... our teenage daughter, Chloe, she was 18 at the time, had a major car accident and broke her neck and her back, and ended up in our biggest trauma hospital in New Zealand, where she had superb clinical care. There's no complaints about that. But she ended up in hospital for 3 months with a broken neck and a broken back, being conservatively managed in spinal traction. So she was tied down to a bed for 3 months with her head completely immobilized. And although her clinical care was really good and she was under the care of a surgeon I knew well, I had anaesthetized for many times in my role as an anaesthetic consultant, it was the complete neglect of her really basic human needs. So she's lying in a bed, she can only see the ceiling, she can't read a book or a magazine, she can't see a television, she can't look out the window, she can't even see the faces of people who come in the room. And our assumption was in this very big, flash, new biggest hospital in New Zealand that they would quickly perform a disability assessment and figure out what disability and communication aid she needed to connect her back to the world. And that utterly failed. It simply did not happen. In the 3 months in hospital, she never had a disability assessment. The occupational therapist never came to visit her, even though they agreed that was their job. Right. Such was the pressure on their service and priorities, it never happened. And another thing that you need to survive and to recover from injuries, apart from psychological well-being, is really tasty, nutritious food, and hospitals are incapable of providing that. Mm. We have a great system to bring meal trays to a room and an hour later take it out again. This food is, she's a vegetarian, so the food is very unappetizing. It has almost no nutritional value. It's out of sight, it's out of reach. She can't feed herself. Many days she actually went hungry.
Right.
In our biggest hospital. So Meredith, my wife, set up a kitchen in her room and for 100 days cooked tasty, nutritious food for her twice a day to make sure that, A, that she had something to look forward to and enjoy, and B, that she had the nutrition she needed to recover from injuries. That cost us more than $1,000 in hospital car parking, even though the hospital care was free. So she did make a great recovery from her injuries physically, and she walked unaided out of the hospital after 3 months. Mm. And we're really grateful for that. But if we had not intervened to support, I installed a laptop computer, which I mounted on the bed frame, and Meredith was there to provide her with the food she needed. And with that support, she made a great recovery. But at the time, I was a powerful person in healthcare. I had been a senior specialist anaesthetist in that very hospital. Mm-hmm. I had been the corporate advisor for quality and safety in that hospital on the executive team. At the time, I was a member of a national committee advising the New Zealand government on quality and safety in healthcare. And yet, with all that power and authority, I simply couldn't get the hospital to respond at all to the basic human needs, beyond the clinical care of a pathology. So that was the experience that radicalized me.
Yeah, right.
And gave me a commitment to try to do something about it.
Well, a pretty salutary tale, but anyway, it inspired you to get out there and try and make a change, which is brilliant, of course. So you've written an amazing book, Time to Care. It's a brilliant mix of science and sheer humanity, and it does make an unequivocal case for change. One of its most powerful messages is that beyond the obvious benefits to patients of a more caring system, the benefits to doctors and staff are equally powerful. In fact, its subtitle is How to Love Your Patients and Your Job. Can you tell us more about this?
Sure. And of course, in medicine, whenever we approach a problem, we always focus on the pathology, on the problem, never the solution. So there's a great deal of research to burnout among doctors especially. And typically the approach is to measure the pathology. So we use the Maslach burnout inventory to measure how burnt out doctors are and then try to seek the reasons underlying that. We decided to take the opposite approach because we use a lot of appreciative inquiry in our work. We're seeking stories of the very best. So we invented a questionnaire which asks people about the joy and satisfaction and happiness they got out of compassionate caring, both individually caring for patients and within the setting of the work environment. And this was scored, an anonymous questionnaire scored out of 100. And we asked anyone who scored more than 70 out of 100, please, if they wouldn't mind, can they get in touch and give us their email address? Because we'd really like to interview them to find out how come they are flourishing and happy in a work environment where everyone else is burning out. So we've met and talked to a number of those individuals in different countries. And the story they tell is pretty much universal, the same. They have a very deep commitment to compassion and caring. They come to work every single day, not focusing on all of the frustrations and the difficulties, but really deliberately focusing in a mindful way on the extraordinary privilege of having deep and intimate human connections, through the day. Mm. They bring very deliberate practices of kindness, of appreciation, of gratitude. They're not only kind, especially kind to their patients, but they're very kind and appreciative and supportive to their colleagues as well. And they invest in their own health and well-being. They invest in mindfulness. They make sure they have a work-life balance. They exercise. They eat well. They nourish and cherish themselves first, and that gives them the capacity to look after the patients. But it's that deep human connection. Now, I'm an anesthetic specialist. I trained for 14 years from starting at the medical school to being appointed as a consultant anesthetist. It's a long haul. And there was a tremendous challenge in learning all of the very complex specialist knowledge and developing a whole range of physical skills and capacities to deal with different situations and the sickest and most severely injured patient. And I had a lot of pride in those kind of technical achievements and academic achievements. But, there comes a point in kind of mid-career where that kind of becomes routine. And maybe even starts to get a little bit boring because there's not a challenge anymore. And what we know from talking to so many people that ultimately what is much more deeply rewarding is the human connection, is the compassion and caring. We know from science and from ancient traditions like Buddhism that every act of compassion is not just an act of compassion for another, it's an act of compassion for yourself. Mm. It fills and warms and strengthens your own heart. And those are the qualities shown by the people who are flourishing and resilient and don't suffer from burnout.
Right. Well, very interesting. So it shouldn't really be necessary to argue the case that health care should be caring, but sadly we do live in a world where scientific proof of common sense and the need for basic human values is a requisite for change at an organisational level. Mm-hmm. So this book of yours, The Time to Care, does have the science that demonstrates that taking care is cheaper, more efficient, more effective. Can you give us some examples?
Yeah, that was really astonishing to me. As a highly trained doctor, to go back to the medical journals and start finding the research evidence. And what I came across just was remarkable. For instance, in my role as an anaesthetist, there are two different ways in which I can approach the patient in the preoperative consultation, the anxious patient anticipating going forward for surgery. And I have a variety of technical tasks to do in that consultation, to do a thorough anaesthetic and medical assessment, to explain to the patient the procedures I'm going to use, what I recommend to get informed consent. And for most of my career, I did that in a very clinically detached way. I was nice and I was kind, but I was very focused on the clinical agenda. Well, there's now two randomized controlled trials that ask anaesthetists to do that preoperative consultation in one of two different ways. One is the way I've described, which is kind of clinically focused and detached, and the other is to add more empathy and warmth and positivity and to build some rapport and trust with the patient and make suggestions for how they could cope with the pain after surgery and mobilize more quickly and make a better recovery. And what it turns out that in randomized control trials, just 5 to 10 minutes of either a clinically detached relationship or a warm, supportive, compassionate relationship, that can halve the dose of morphine that the patient requires after major surgery.
Wow.
That it can substantially reduce the length of hospital stay. That if you objectively measure the wound healing with a microscope day by day, it is objective improvement in surgical wound healing. There are improvement in surgical outcomes. There's less pain and there's less anxiety of the patients. They get out of bed and mobilize more quickly. It's really remarkable, just 5 minutes. And the question is, how can this be happening? How can just a 5 or 10 minute intervention be having a time course of impact that's lasting for days and days? There's more evidence too, a big study in Italy of 20,000 insulin-dependent diabetics who rated their doctor, and is this a high-empathy doctor or a low-empathy doctor? And the patients who belonged to high-empathy doctors had far fewer acute emergency hospital admissions, 42% fewer less than the patients who belonged to low-empathy doctors. Another study, a randomized controlled trial of patients with terminal lung cancer. And all the patients, this is in the USA, they were fully funded by the insurance company to access any aggressive medical treatment they wanted to try to stay alive a bit longer, chemotherapy, radiotherapy, surgery, but only half of that group had access to a palliative care physician who provided compassionate whole person care based on the patient's goals, not talking about when do we schedule the next round of chemotherapy. What's interesting in that study is that those patients had much less rates of clinical depression, had better quality of life. They made very different decisions about care. They'd say to the oncologist, sorry, doc, I don't have time for the next round of chemotherapy because I'm going to see my new grandson. That was a more important life goal. Mm-hmm. So they were turning down treatments. So the cost of care actually fell significantly. What's remarkable is those patients who were turning down the medical treatments were living 30 to 40% longer than those who just have aggressive medical care.
Wow.
And there are just more and more studies now showing this kind of effect. So, yes, the science is really important. It's extremely surprising to most doctors. It was very surprising to me.
Right.
What we've learned, though, is that you can't persuade people to change, that giving them science, you know, is not enough. We actually have to fundamentally change some of the values in healthcare. We have to change the drivers behind, you know, what people actually do each day.
Mm. So it's an ingredient, isn't it, the science? It definitely backs it up, but as you say, something very
it certainly
fundamental.
Helps.
Yeah, but especially when it's as good as the science you've just given us, those results are the kind of thing that drug companies would die for. But it is one of the ingredients, but you're right that some fundamental change needs to happen in the system in which everybody's operating, isn't it? It's the environment. This behaviour is happening inside, and as you say, the drivers are the wrong drivers very often, aren't they?
Yeah, because I've written a blog about this very subject, because in healthcare there's sort of espoused values. You know, organisations say, we're all here about compassion and caring and taking care of our patients. Those are the espoused values. The real values are that doctors will focus almost entirely on materialistic science. By that, I mean that instead of caring for a whole person, or even acknowledging that a patient is a conscious human being, that they're making a medical diagnosis and giving a standardized treatment for that diagnosis, a medication or a surgery. That's materialistic science that doesn't see the person. We have the industrialization of healthcare that I talked about before. And then finally, we have the profit motive. And that's really interesting because in the UK and in New Zealand, we have basically a free healthcare system, taxpayer funded. And you think, well, why would profit be anything to do with it? The answer is that almost all of the research funding for advances in healthcare comes from pharmaceutical and technology companies. And the only things that they're interested in researching are highly expensive treatments that they can sell for a great deal of money that can be patented. Mm-hmm. So the only new drugs that come on the market, there's never a cheap drug that comes onto the market, right? It's always a $10,000 drug. A $100,000 drug is the exciting new advance. There are compassionate approaches to caring for patients and helping them to heal, which cannot be patented, which earn very little money, which are highly effective, which never ever ever get researched, because we have a profit-driven technology and pharmaceutical system that is driving healthcare. So the only drugs and technologies I have in New Zealand to treat patients, by and large, are highly expensive patented technologies. Mm. So even in a non-profit healthcare system, profit plays a very large part. So those, and then the fourth value that underpins what happens in healthcare is a kind of heroic model that doctors adapt, where it's simply not okay for doctors to have feelings, to have vulnerabilities. God help a doctor if he actually admits to having a mental illness or being depressed, because that can be the end of a career. So we there are an awful lot of issues within healthcare that are just undiscussable. We're seeing very high rates of physician suicide in the USA, about 400 doctors a year. That's more than the output of an entire medical school wasted each year, because doctors have this professional culture in which we're superheroes, not allowed to talk about our feelings. That makes it very difficult to kind of change the system, the culture, because we won't even talk about it.
Mm.
So those are the real drivers behind healthcare, and those are the things that have to change. And we need to move to a much more holistic approach to caring for people rather than just treating pathologies. We need a healthcare system that realizes that it's dramatically more effective to make a human connection, to slow down, to take some time, to dig down and uncover root causes rather than to have a hurried system that always treats symptoms. And we need to bring some of the developments of health science out of the profit domain and have publicly funded research into really cheap and effective forms of treatment that cannot be patented, but nonetheless are of great benefit to patients. And we need to change the culture of medicine so that doctors start to talk about their own health and well-being and the vulnerability. And it's okay for a doctor to cry. And it's okay for a doctor to take the time out, you know, on a mental health day or whatever. So those are the things that need to change.
Mm. Well, fantastic to hear you pointing to some of those, as you say, massive drivers, really, that are just, well, they're not even out there, really, and not on the agenda at all. And, this apparent free healthcare, and as you say, well, what nurse money got to do with that? This doesn't seem to be a factor, but of course it is, and unfortunately healthcare has largely always been for profit. And that suggestion you just made about the fact that the it's government's responsibility to really lift out these aspects of care that are unprofitable and actually find out what works and support those things for the benefit of the population, for the health of their people. And that's the only place really that funding can come from. To some extent, things like this are happening, they're kind of grassroots movements, so where people are banding together and saying, come on, we're going to do it for each other. And that's a fantastic thing, I think. I love that whole social media aspect of people supporting each other. You know, really, it comes back to governments that should be doing this for us. So very good to hear you talk about that. The other thing very good to hear you talk about is this role of doctors. It's the downside of doctor as God. Doctor as God obviously has a lot of upside for the people who are ambitious and like to be in a position of power and respect and all of that. But there's a massive price that they pay on the other side for having to be infallible and having to have no weaknesses in their own psyche or anything else or their physical body. And I think you probably agree that this is the primary source of doctor burnout.
It's certainly a very important cause. But I think, you know, the kind of materialistic science that we're taught at medical school, that's in all the medical journals that we hear about at a medical conference we go to, it gets us into a role where we're only treating pathology and disease, not actually caring for the patient. The problem with that is that completely disenfranchises the patient from ever taking responsibility for their own health and well-being.
Right.
Because actually, it is normal for human beings to live into their 60s and 70s, you know, without any chronic disease. Chronic disease like high blood pressure and heart disease and obesity and diabetes, these are abnormalities. And yet we've kind of, you know, every middle-aged patient I see in the clinic is taking a cholesterol drug, an antihypertensive, a diabetic medication. We actually give doctors incentives to, you know, screen for patients and give these drug prescriptions. So we actually have a medicated sickness system rather than a healthcare system. But the problem with that for doctors is that if you completely disenfranchise patients from taking care of their own health and well-being, then you make yourself responsible for every single symptom and every single unhappiness that the patient brings to your door.
Yes.
And then the burden becomes overwhelming. We start to see of our patients as just this terrible burden of demand on our services, on us individually. And this is what we're seeing in the NHS and the winter crisis that's all over the media at the moment. Just complete overwhelm. But when you really study the science of the extraordinary capacity of human beings to heal themselves, the natural capacity of human beings to recover from injury, from illness, to remain well into advanced age, if you treat the person rather than just the pathology, then you can begin to perceive that, oh my goodness, my patients are not a burden of demand. They're actually the most abundant resource of resilience, of recovery, of healing, of health and well-being. When you partner with your patients, suddenly there's this enormous resource you can tap into, which is actually the patient's own life. And because it's a partnership, the doctor doesn't have this terrible burden of being responsible for everything. You're actually handing the responsibility back to the patient. You know, this is your life. I'm going to be here to support you, to advise you, to coach you, to help you to heal, to be here to listen, you know, when you're injured or hurt or, you know, distressed. And it's a very different role in partnership and walking alongside each other, which allows you to step back from this burden of being responsible for everything. And also, when you get deeper and deeper into that practice and learn something about mindfulness and about wisdom, you kind of realize that, you know, we tend to have a belief that it's the doctor's treatment that makes the patients better. That's just not true at all. It's 90% of the patient's own innate healing capacity that's helped a bit with a treatment, although sometimes it's actually hindered. And as you grow older and wiser, you start to be a bit more humble about your role as a doctor. You realize that whether or not a patient survives, it's not, you know, whether you chose the exact right dose of medication or did a fantastic surgery, but there are much greater things in this world, in this universe, that determine the survival or not of a patient, or, you know, how well a patient does. And you become more humble and you start to be less attached to being so individually responsible for what happens, the outcome of the patient. What instead it allows you to do is to be in deep service to the patient from a place of, you know, more wisdom and mindfulness, which is actually much more effective medicine. You're likely actually to get better outcomes, but you're not so attached to the outcomes. And these are the things that you develop with wisdom, with compassion, that you know, are very, very different from the typical GP that's just writing a script every 10 minutes and just feels overwhelmed.
Well, that's an inspirational picture you're painting of a doctor, and I'm sure that's exactly the kind of doctor that a lot of our listeners would give anything for. So another great feature of your book is that it's very practical. You and others have direct experience of creating change within a system that's heavily resistant, and the book gives specific advice on meeting the challenges that are part and parcel of such initiatives. This is a great resource for pioneers of compassion. Can you tell us more about the resources in your book?
Sure. The first thing I try to do in the book is really, you know, to talk about reality. I mean, page one of the book gets to the heart of, you know, what's so painful about healthcare, about the bad experiences of patients, about doctors burning out, about the reality of the crisis. Because I want people to understand that, yeah, I know, I've been there, I understand where you are. And then it starts to offer hope. And it starts to reshape and reframe the whole picture, saying that there are actually doctors and nurses out there who are joyous and flourishing and doing great work in the same kind of system that you're in. And here's some neuroscience behind it, and here's some positive psychology behind it. And here are the inspiring stories that we've gathered from around the world with people who've managed to make that change. And these are the ways that you can, you know, begin to cognitively restructure and rethink about your work. These are the simple practices like kindness and appreciation, gratitude, that can make a tremendous difference. And you know, these are the real stories from people who have done it and the science behind it. And I think, you know, when I sit back and think after 13, 14 years, you know, what have I achieved with this tremendous effort? You know, I can't point to a hospital and say, well, we transformed that hospital and that's just a wonderfully compassionate place. What I can point to is, you know, many thousands and maybe, you know, tens of thousands of health professionals around the world that in one way or another have come in contact with our work, have read my book, have read something on our website, have shared a resource, have watched a, you know, a little video on YouTube, and it's begun to change their practice. And it's begun them on that journey from kind of despair and burnout to thinking, actually, there could be a better way. And the wonderful thing is that even if you make the tiniest change to your practice by just, for instance, deciding each day that you would do one small act of kindness. Mm-hmm. The positive feedback you get from that, the reward you get from that is so great that it encourages you enormously and you think, well, I'm going to take it another step.
Right.
So it starts to become an irreversible journey.
Mm.
So we've had wonderful letters from people saying, I was going to quit medicine and I was just burnt out and I was despairing and now I'm in flourishing and happy practice again, you know, thanks to the work that you do.
Mm.
So I think we've helped change many individuals, and I think there's a growing movement of people who realize that compassionate care has the answers to many of our great challenges in healthcare. So there's a growing awareness, but the institutions themselves, the hospitals and clinics, pretty stubbornly resist change because they're actually operating on a different set of values.
Mm. Fantastic. Great. Well, it's so inspiring to hear stories of people turning around like that, because, of course, we desperately need people who understand this and know what the change is, what they need to do. Patients are left high and dry otherwise by a system that's just burning out, basically. So a fantastic inspiration to have clear guidelines about what's missing and what you can do to address those gaps. So you've already spoken a little bit about the effects of care and compassion on patients. You've given us a little bit of the science of how amazing that is. Complementary and alternative medicine, I think, excels in this area, and it has a great awareness of the placebo effect and the nocebo effect, the power of the relationship between the practitioner and the patient. So, yeah, conventional mm-hmm. medicine, I think we agree, is missing a huge resource for healing here. And even unwittingly working against the patient's well-being sometimes. I know you're very vocal on this subject. Why do you feel so strongly about this particular aspect, the relationship?
Well, first of all, the science really helps us, because at medical school, I was taught all about clinical detachment. I was taught that I had to be emotionally separate from a patient for two reasons. First of all, that I could not be able to make objective clinical decisions if my emotions are in the way. I had to stand back and be the cool detective.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, that because I was going to witness patients in pain and suffering and death, that I had to protect myself psychologically and put up barriers and maintain my distance, because if I had that close connection, I was just going to burn out. Well, I can say unequivocally that science says that both those decisions are just wrong.
Right.
And indeed, ancient wisdom traditions knew that. Human beings are profoundly and intimately connected together. I demonstrate this every time I speak. I ask an audience member to come up close within 2 or 3 feet of me.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell a story that if you put an ECG electrode to measure my heartbeat and EEG electrodes to measure the brainwave of the person next to me, in a neuroscience lab, pretty quickly you can find that there's evidence that the person's brainwaves, some of them are starting to synchronize with my heartbeat and vice versa. And there's actually an electrophysiological connection between human beings that stand close together.
Mm.
And then we've got the whole empathy system with mirror neurons that allows us to intuitively understand another person's feelings and emotions and intentions. And now there's a whole new branch of neuroscience called interpersonal neurodevelopment that describes, for instance, how a mother and baby actually rewire and change each other's nervous system day by day, because this connection is so profound, it's so intimate.
Right.
So human beings are profoundly connected together. And so as a physician, I've realized I have to be exquisitely sensitive about the quality of spirit I bring to my patients, because in the physiology lab, you can show that if you have an anxious patient with the sympathetic system activated and increased heart rate and blood pressure and stress responses and inflammatory responses starting, that if the physician is really centered and grounded and calm, that actually changes the physiology of the patient without a touch, even without a word. And I use this in the operating room when an anxious patient comes into the operating room, lies down in the operating bed, by bringing a very calm and compassionate and caring presence. I see the heart rate and the blood pressure sucking down, even without a drug, even without saying anything.
Mm.
So we have this capacity to elicit a healing response in patients. And what we suspect now is that this actually changes gene expression within minutes. It changes protein synthesis. It changes the way the immune system works. It enhances tissue healing. It dampens down the dangerous inflammatory responses and stress responses, and it leaves a positive emotional memory that the patient indeed may have for the rest of their lives. And every time the patient remembers that moment of compassion and caring, it turns on this whole healing response again. And the explanation for why 5 minutes of being really compassionate with the patient before surgery can have this amazing effect on outcomes for many days afterwards.
Right.
On the other hand, if I'm angry, if I'm frustrated, if I'm judgmental, if I don't think this patient deserves treatment because they're a drunkard or a smoker or obese or they don't take care of themselves or whatever, and we as doctors, you know, we often make judgments about patients, or you're just burnt out, you actually harm the patient. It's like sticking a knife into the patient's chest. You're turning on bad genes. You're eliciting stress responses. You're inhibiting the immune system. You're inhibiting wound healing. So that quality of connection between the health professional and the patient is of absolutely critical importance. Often I think we're just unaware of the profound effect we have on people. And I'm really surprised from time to time when I get a letter from a patient who says, "Dear Dr. Youngson, you probably don't remember me, but you were my anaesthetist 6 months ago. Mm-hmm. And I came into the operating room really frightened, and I had breast cancer, and I need to tell you that, you know, you had such a profound impact on me that I just felt so calm, so relaxed, I felt more confident, that, you know, you had this wonderful spirit, you made eye contact, you were at my level, that we had lovely touch, your voice was soft, and this, you know, I remember that every single day." So we have no idea at all the impact we have on people.
And, gives me goosebumps just hearing you tell that story.
and that's, you know, that's the nature of the compassionate connection. And sometimes the most profound healing occurs when we do absolutely nothing other than be present in deep compassion and openness and kindness and willing to witness another person's suffering and despair and not feel we had to jump in and do something and just totally validate that human being by saying that in their darkest place, you're willing to sit there next to them and be with them and breathe with them and not feel you have to give them a diagnosis or jump in or fix them or whatever. We hear stories from doctors and nurses of that nature, of the most incredibly profound healing that occurs, of people after 20 years of severe depression and suicide turning their lives around simply because one doctor was willing to sit in silence and be with them in deep compassion. And I guess you hear the emotion in my voice because I'm deeply moved by stories.
Me too. So, yeah, you're talking about the most profound level of our human connection, really, and how powerful that actually is.
Yeah, that's the healing power of love.
Right. So I want to come to integrative medicine now. This show is all about integrative medicine for cancer. And cancer is a field of medicine that's possibly more in need of the changes that you're driving than any other. That's in my experience. Integration seems to provide a route for the empathic skills of complementary medicine to infiltrate the conventional care system. Do you think that integration is some kind of step towards a more caring system?
I was corresponding with someone who works in oncology just yesterday, talking on this very subject and saying, making that exact point. The first organization that stepped forward to invite me to speak ever at a conference about compassionate care and healthcare was the Australasian Integrative Medicine Association, AIMA. In fact, I've spoken 5 times at their conferences over the year, and they embraced us. And what was so striking for me is, actually, I was a little scared going to that conference because, you know, I was a highly trained hospital specialist, anesthetic specialist doing very technical medicine, and I was going to this conference full of all these weird people and these kind of healers and complementary and alternative. Because at that time, I had a you know, somewhat dim view of some of those practices, because I'd come from a very materialistic, technical, medical background. And that's the nature of my training. So I wondered what I was actually doing there at all. But when I stepped into the conference, I was so struck that there was such an atmosphere of warmth and love in the room. And it was in such contrast to the medical conferences I go to. And that encouraged me greatly. And when I stood up on the stage, I had decided already that I wouldn't have any slides, that I'd do better to tell human stories. And then I thought maybe it'd be better if I was vulnerable. So I asked if they could take the podium off the stage, which they did. And then 10 minutes before I got on the stage, I threw my notes away and just trusted that I could get on a stage with nothing to hide behind, no notes, no slides, and somehow string together. And that was the impact on me of integrative medicine, of a group of people that were could see far beyond just the treatment of pathology to caring for a whole human being, that were willing to be open to and accept a wide range of other healing methodologies that, you know, the medical profession tends to poo-poo. And I think it's in terms of the holistic care of the patient or the person, probably we don't call them the patient so much, is that that certainly is, you know, a major step in the right direction. And as we and as integrated medicine starts to infiltrate oncology units and complementary and alternative therapists get into the building, and as oncologists and surgeons and doctors and anesthetists start to learn more about some of those ancient wisdoms and techniques, then it starts to change their practice. And so there's a kind of infiltration going on, which is definitely a move in the right direction.
All right, great. It seems a great movement to me. So we're getting towards the end of the show, but I want to talk about hearts in healthcare. So in response to the international situation that I was talking about at the start of the show, you've initiated this worldwide movement for compassion in healthcare. You've travelled the globe extolling the virtues of rehumanising healthcare and inspiring change. Can you tell us all about Hearts in Healthcare and some of the successes you're most proud of?
So, we have a pretty sophisticated website, and we worked with a wonderful... The first website we built was a disaster. In the end, we just turned it off and walked away and wasted a lot of our money and started again. And we worked with a wonderful designer who worked with us for a whole year to really clarify who we are and what our message is and what we're trying to achieve, and to portray that in a really attractive and compelling way. So we have a wonderful website that has an enormous amount of resource. And we just we give away all of our resources. Over the years, I've given, I don't know, hundreds of keynote addresses in some quite prestigious events in countries around the world. But I give away all of my slides. And if you go to our website, there's my complete collection of 120 most beautifully designed slides with beautiful images, beautiful fonts, with all of the notes together with each slide and all the scientific references, all the evidence-based practice. And we just give those away to anyone in the whole world. So what we're trying to do is to encourage people to take our material, to spread it around the world, to run their own workshops within their hospitals and clinics. And that's happening in lots of different places. It's happening in Hungary, it's happening in Saudi Arabia, it's happening in Canada, happening in Australia, it's happening in the Netherlands, it's happening in Ireland. It's just lots of different places. People who are becoming leaders in their own right, because Hearts in Healthcare actually is one half of my time, because I'm a practicing clinician, and it's a bit of Meredith, my wife. She and I are the co-founders, and we don't have any staff. And I run the website single-handed. And, you know, because we have what appears to be a sophisticated organization communication, people often, you know, imagine we have this big staff. We don't. Right. So really our purpose is to encourage others to take the word forward. There's, you know, there's a very small limit to what Robin Youngson personally can do in the world. I think my book has been the most important thing, because that's changed, you know, more people than anything else. And I'm just at the moment assembling all the material to write a second edition, which has got 5 more years' worth of science and stories and experience and insights and wisdom from many countries around the world. So it's going to be greatly expanded. And my plan is to give that book away completely for free, to make the PDF available in English to anyone in the world who wants it without asking for payment. If people want to make a payment, they can. And we want to get it translated into 10 languages, the new edition. The first edition is already in Dutch and German and Hungarian.
Right.
But we're in conversation with different people around the world, say, let's crowdfund this and let's get it translated and let's get this book free to the whole world in as many languages as we can, because the book has been the one thing that's probably changed things more than anything else. There are some places where we've been able to create some more sustained change. That's very rarely been within the context of an organization. And we've had to reframe the work to a higher level. So there's a city in Kentucky in the United States called Louisville, which is the model compassionate city under the International Charter for Compassion. And Meredith and I have made 5 visits there over 5 or 6 years. And we've been supporting the work of the city to become a compassionate city, and in particular played a role in encouraging compassionate healthcare. Okay. And our last visit, we did 61 presentations, workshops, meetings, and events across 31 organizations.
Wow.
In the whole city over 6 weeks. And that has created a kind of field change within the whole city, where there is many ongoing programs led by many local champions that are pushing forward compassionate care in the setting of a whole city. And that's been much more successful than just trying to change things in one hospital or one clinic. So we're kind of excited.
I can imagine. Sounds amazing. Wow. Well, look, that's amazing. Anyway, we have to finish. I'd like to finish, though, with a call to action. What can people do to help your campaign, be they healthcare practitioners or the public?
For health professionals, the very first thing that's so important is self-compassion and self-care and taking care of yourself. The World Health Organization self-compassion is Kristen Neff. We've met with her several times. She's got a wonderful website and a book with that title, Self-Compassion. Start looking after yourself first. You can never serve your patients if you're not looking after yourself first. Start to invest in the personal practices that give more meaning in your work, that kindness, that appreciation, that gratitude, that choosing to love your work, choosing to reflect on the privilege of the work you do, the privilege of human connection, of those intimate connections. And then you will profoundly change yourself, because the only way to change the world is to change yourself. I think for ordinary members of the public, my book is very accessible. It's been read by many people who are not health professionals. It's written in very plain language. And people have said, oh, Robin, you should have written that for education or local government or whatever, because it's about humanity, it's about human connection. I think if you want your doctor to be more compassionate, start caring for your doctor. You know, at the end of an appointment, say, Doc, you know, I'm concerned for you. How are you doing?
Right.
You know, is there something I can do to make your job easier? You know, just something a bit startling like that.
I mean, right.
You know, or maybe organize a campaign in your town where a flash mob of 100 people run into the hospital at 8 o'clock in the morning when all the new shift is coming on and just give hugs to lots of doctors and nurses, or write them thank you cards, or, you know. We have to start showing care and compassion to our health professionals.
Right.
They are hurting mightily. They're burning out.
Right.
And that's something that, you know, any ordinary person can do. And we've heard inspiring stories like that of people that have really changed their doctors. Buy a copy of my book and give it to your doctor.
Yes.
I mean, you know, there's lots of guerrilla tactics you can employ.
Well, it's easy to tell that you've been radicalized, Robin. some great ideas. Look, we're going to have to end it there. You said a little while ago that there's a limit to what little Robin Youngson can achieve, and I'd actually like to counter that in just the same way as you don't really realize what's happening when you put a hand on somebody at the bedside and comfort them, and, you know, 6 months later they're telling you that this was the most important thing that happened. I think there's no way you're going to know just how much effect your efforts are having now and will have in the future. I think you've thrown a big pebble in the pond, and I think practitioners and patients around the world are going to be benefiting from your efforts. So, you know, enormous thank you from me personally on behalf of patients who we're trying to help. I just wish you ever more success.
Well, thank you, Robin. That's very kind of you. Pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you. I can't imagine that any of you listening will have failed to be uplifted and inspired by that. As Robin said, his book, Time to Care, is a totally accessible read, so I hope many of you will want to read it, either because you're a professional working within our emotionally stunted healthcare system, or someone who has experienced or is experiencing the shortcomings in care of that system. Buy the book, and once you've read it, give it to your oncologist, surgeon, radiotherapist, GP, or whoever you feel it would most benefit. There are links to material mentioned in today's show, including Robin's book, on the Yes to Life website. That's yestolife.org.uk. Just click the Yes to Life show logo on the homepage. I hope you can join me again next week for another Yes to Life show. Goodbye.